brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
A problem shared becomes half a problem, because once you start to hear yourself say it, you start to then figure it out and you find a way. When we keep it inside, we're behind enemy lines and we're attacking ourselves. And that's where the real battle takes place, man. You've got the routine, you got all that stuff, but a lot of those are just going to be fixes. When it's really delving into, man, what's the feeling? And what's the feeling that you're having when you are shooting well? What's the feeling that you want to have? That becomes a goal instead of 100% outcome and making it and missing it, because then it's tight, then it's tension, and it's really tough to play that way.
Dr. Rob Bell is a mental toughness coach who has worked with athletes in a variety of sports at all levels. He has coached PGA Tour winners, Olympic medalists, a USTA national champion, and the Indy 11 pro soccer team. Dr. Bell is the author of 7 books on mental toughness, including his latest, Puke and Rally. He has been featured on ESPN, Fox News, The Golf Channel, New York Times, Runner's World, and Stack Magazine. Dr. Bell also speaks to businesses and corporations, including Marriott, Walgreens, Morgan Stanley, and the PGA of America, among many others. He has been a certified consultant since 2006 for the Association for Applied Sports Psychology. Dr. Bell is the host of his own sports psychology podcast, 15 Minutes of Mental Toughness. Take some notes on improving your mental toughness as you listen to this episode with Dr. Rob Bell. Hey, Hoopheads. This February, our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are offering $1,250 off the Dr. Dish Rebel Plus. You can also subscribe to their 30-day free daily motivational email series for coaches. Check out their new goal-setting feature at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT Plus models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Sean McDonald, boys varsity basketball coach at University School in Cleveland, Ohio. You're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new FastDraw and FastScout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improve communication with your team. FastModel also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. FastModel Sports is the best in basketball. Take some notes on improving your mental toughness as you listen to this episode with Dr. Rob Bell. Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinsley here with my co-host, Jason Sunkel, tonight. And we are pleased to be joined by Dr. Rob Bell, sports psychology coach, speaker, author of the new book, Puke and Rally. Rob, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Hey, thanks for having me. Mike, Jason, appreciate it, man.
Absolutely. Excited to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the interesting things that you've been able to do in your career. We're going to definitely talk a little bit about the book. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about your athletic background, how you got into sports when you were younger.
Great question, man. I always love that question too, because I mean, sports was really just my entire life. Played everything. And I was always like, my daughter even now will say, well, daddy, like, you're great at everything, right? Like, that's like, it's really odd to me sometimes to like see kids, like some kids that just don't have any physical capability at all, because they never had to like run,
right?
Like, you know, to watch a kid that's never thrown a ball or kick a ball, it's just really foreign to me. So it's like, my daughter would say, daddy, like, you're so great at everything. And I said, no, I'm good at everything. Like, I can play anything, but I'm not great at anything. You know what I mean? It was like, not until like later years, but man, I mean, baseball and soccer were probably my best loves, man. But I mean, it was, every single sport I absolutely loved, whether it was like pogo stick or if it was like, you know, John, giant slalom skiing man or tennis or if it's going to be basketball. I mean, I still think NCAA basketball, the tournament's probably the best sporting event like that there is. That's really, I still never change on that. And like growing up, man, I mean, when Wimbledon would come, I remember like I would practice, but I would come in and I'd watch every single match of like Wimbledon. It was like, we had like HBO at that time, you know, from round one on as much as I could. I mean, so I was just, sports really was my entire life. So growing up and then, you know, kind of getting off the tracks a little bit, and I can always share about that, but it was like, I knew something in my world was going to be like within sports. I mean, that's how much it was. And it was always like, how do we make this transition from this part of sport? And that's what I love about athletes today. It's like being able to look at them. It's like, look, you have to realize that the effort that you're putting in, the practice that you're putting in, this translates into real life. If you can kind of see how these dots are going to connect, you know, because these skills are going to last way beyond when sport is over. And that's why I'm just such a honk, I think, when it comes to, you know, athletics and sport in general.
Did athletics, did that come from your family, or was that something that you sort of came to on your own as a kid, or were you coming from an athletic family?
I mean, there weren't any D1 athletes. I mean, my dad was, you know, old school football player. My brother played soccer. So, you know, my goal was always to be better than him. Right. I mean, but it was just the fact of, you know, being in a small town and you just get out there and you just do it, right? You just play. So it's going to be pickup basketball, or it's going to be, you know, home run derby or whatever it is, or football. We just played. So, I mean, that was just, it was just kind of the fit on how things went, you know.
What's your take on how kids grow up today versus the way that you grew up with sports? Because obviously today, far, far different, where so much more of our kids' sports are organized and parent-driven, and there's a coach, and versus what you're describing, which is the same way I grew up, where you're in the backyard, you're just making up games with your friends, and you're playing every single sport, versus today, we know that just the way the system is set up, that it's harder for kids to dabble in a bunch of different sports. They feel a lot more pressure. Parents, I think, feel a lot more pressure on getting into something early, because if you don't know, you're going to fall behind and this and that. So just what's your take on how you grew up versus how our kids grow up today?
Yeah. I mean, the real quick part is, I mean, we have to, it's kind of like those that criticize the generation forget like kind of who raised them. You know what I
Correct.
Mean? It's like, you know, participation trophies, it's more about the parents than it is the kids. You know, it really is, right? And it's like, I'll say, I mean, adults, sorry for the tangent. I will go off on tangents, man, but like—
We love tangents. Go for
it. Yeah, I love it, man. So it's like, you know, adults, think about the adult participation trophies that we have today. Because I will have, and I will see it, man, that people that run the half marathon and then just post, I mean, they want to post that finishing medal. That's their participation trophy. You know, like,
right.
You know what? There's nothing wrong with it, man. That's great, man. You ran it. You know what I mean? But it's like, we kind of take that same viewpoint and then just have it onto the kids as well. So it's like the part that I think misses. So I guess my whole thing is like, we still need to adapt to how things change instead of just always wishing for things that they were. I mean, but I get geeked up. Like when I will see pickup game, like I saw a pickup game, there weren't any adults around. I just sat and watched because I wanted to see like how that kind of transpired. And loved it, man. You know, it was a wiffle ball game. I mean, I just love that stuff because sport teaches whatever we want it to teach. And when it's just the kids that are doing it, they have to, they have to self-govern themselves, right? So if anybody's going to be cheating or fouling, whatever it is, you call it on yourself. Like that's, you self-govern it. And I think that's part of a skill of growing up. Like, look, that's going to last. You're going to have to speak up for yourself sort of thing, right? I mean, that skill. The other part, though, that I think is even more important is the creativity. And if there's any thing that really frustrates coaches is when, you know, and even college level, it's when things go wrong, they can't figure it out. What's the precedence that's been set? Well, when something's wrong, you got to go here, you got to go here, and they will tell you what it is that you're doing wrong, and then you fix it. Well, that doesn't work all the time, right? And it's not always going to work. You have to be able to find a way. You have to be able to figure it out. And part of being able to figure out is when things are going bad. And it's sort of just that creative muscle, man. Like if you've got the bottle cap, that's going to be second base. And then, you know, this Coke you know, Coke cup here is third. You got to get creative with that piece. And it's like, you have to be able to problem solve. And when parents are always involved and they're the ones that are running it, those are the skills that I see that just aren't there as much, you know? And it's like, it becomes coach driven. It becomes parent driven. Kids don't have to adapt. They don't have to self-govern. They don't have to be creative with it. And those are the skills, again, that, I mean, that's the real injustice that I think is because, you know, with my kids growing up, you know, we played, you have to make up a game. So we go to the park and be like, hey, you got to make up a game. And, you know, American Ninja Warrior was kind of big. And so they'd make up like these courses and stuff like that. And just like being able to take a stick and like dig it in the ground. Right. I mean, there's something to that. You know what I mean? It's like, what, treating you, man, be in the moment. Life doesn't all have to be expectations and stress and results. And, you know, well, let's see how great, you know, you can dig here. And that's part of like going to the beach that I love about, man. It's just kind of digging in the sand and creating stuff. But, you know, sorry for the tangents, but that's what I look at, man. The creativity piece, you got to be able to self-govern and you have to be able to figure out and find a way when things aren't going your way.
Now, those are three great points. And I think when I look at what I do as my day job, so I'm teaching elementary school phys ed, and I couldn't agree with you more, Rob. When I see and hear you describe some of those things, like the ability for kids to self-govern and figure it out and not look to an adult, like a lot of the kids that I teach, their way of trying to figure it out is just screaming at each other. And so they don't really ever get to a negotiation. It's just, I'm yelling at you, you're yelling at me. And then we just kind of are waiting for an adult to step in to help us figure it out. Versus, again, if you have to do that all the time, where if you don't figure it out, guess what? The game ends and everybody goes home and I don't get to play. Well, it's a little bit different stakes for kids today because somebody's always, to your point, somebody's always stepping in. And I think that creativity of being able to understand, okay, well, here's, we want to play baseball, but we've only got seven players. How can we make that work? And you can't hit the ball the right field or this, you know, all the things that you and I grew up with that are just simple things that I think we take for granted that kids today just don't have that opportunity to do. And I think it can get frustrating. I think it's hard for parents because parents just don't have, we don't have the same options. We don't parent in the same way in terms of letting our kids just kind of go out into the neighborhood and figure those things out. So I think there's a whole combination of stuff. I'll be interested to see as I think this is probably, we're getting towards that first generation of kids who grew up differently in front of screens and having all this parental involvement. You know, I'm thinking about on the basketball side of it, AAU basketball has really taken off in the last, let's say 10 years for sure, where you have almost everybody who's playing basketball, regardless of your level, you're playing AAU basketball. Versus, again, you go back 20 years, 25 years, and kids were still playing on the playground and playing in the driveway. And not that kids aren't doing it today, but they're not doing it nearly as much as they used to. So I'll be curious to see what the results are, what the impact is on this generation of kids as they become adults and start to navigate what the adult world looks like.
Yeah, it's a great point, man. Absolutely.
All right, so let's get back to you and kind of your story. As you're going through and you're playing athletics, give me a little bit of your experiences as a high school athlete. If you look back across sports, what's your favorite memory of being a high school athlete?
Whenever I think back on that, I think it's the same answers as a lot of like the pro athletes, man. I just think about the relationships a lot. I think about, you know, some of those bus rides and practical jokes and, you know, when it's going to date me a little bit, you know what I mean? But it's like when we're riding on the bus, man, and we had, you know, the Dave Matthews album came out, you know what I mean? And like everyone was listening to that one or when Pearl Jam came out and everyone's listening to that one, you know what I mean? We're all listening to the same exact thing all on our like Sony Walkman stuff. I just kind of think about that stuff. And it's like, there was a lot of regret, man, with, when I think back of like my high school career, because it kind of, you know, it just got off sideways. I mean, I was really good, I think, younger and kind of relied on that. Didn't work as hard, didn't know how hard I needed to work at it. And then, you know, when discovered partying in high school, and that was, I'd take any kind of extra credit for that because, you know, there was a lot of pain that was kind of going on. And one way to get rid of that pain is just self-medicate, man. So party and party harder that you can. And that was sort of like, even that was like modeled for me that was coming up. So, I mean, That eventually catches up with you, and that caught up with me in high school. Forced me to, I got kicked off my soccer team night before senior year. High expectations, a lot of embarrassment that went with that. And then that translated into putting so much pressure on myself during, when baseball came around, that just tried way too hard. And now you have failure on top of embarrassment. Well, there's only one way to deal with that, man. The only coping mechanism I had was just party harder. So
right.
That translated into college and low Division II school in West Virginia. For some reason, we were partying, go there to play baseball, and we're partying near this bridge, and this bridge was a cliff, and I ended up walking off a 80-foot cliff. I didn't jump. I wasn't pushed. No idea why we were near there, but just had no idea where I was, and hit once and lay him at the bottom of this crevasse that craned me up out of it, take me to the hospital. My mom's a nurse, gaping head wound. Fractured my back, broke my arm, but I was alive, man, and boom, hinge moment, because baseball was over from that point. And whenever I'm talking like with college students or even high school, I just kind of say, look, you can live your life any way that you want, but just trust me that nothing good happens after midnight, right? Nothing good's going to happen after midnight. You just follow that rule, you'll be okay.
Yep.
And then that would cause a lot of pain, man. There's a lot of angst that went with it on messing up. And, this translates into kind of my career, because I didn't know how to cope and handle with the setbacks and the struggle at the time. But I got another second chance when I went to grad school. I was always pretty good intellectually, so that, I never studied one day in high school. I got to college, struggled really hard, but worked my way out of it. But I got into grad school, and I always remember this quote from Lance Armstrong. And regardless of like how we think about him, the quote was pretty righteous. He said, if you ever get a second chance in life, you got to go all the way. And I knew when I got to grad school that I wasn't going to blow it, because I was given a second chance. And I was able to use that energy and that fuel to keep pushing me forward. And, wasn't going to blow the next opportunity that I had.
Prior to your fall, what was the thought process in terms of your career path and what direction you were headed? And then after the fall, did it become clear to you that you wanted to help people to overcome and kind of get that second chance and get into sports psychology? Was it that clear of a moment for you, or was it?
Well, what took place was, I took a psychology class. I never had psychology at all in high school, and I took it in college. And then when I took it in college, it was tattooed in my heart. This is what I want to do. I mean, I don't know how this is going to combine, but I want to combine sport and psychology, and it just fit. And it was tattooed on my heart. This is what I want to do with the rest of my life. And I never, ever stayed away from that. There was also Olympics were going on with Dan and Dave commercials back in the time. Do you remember those?
Oh, yeah. Decathlon. Absolutely.
That's it, man. So Reebok did a fantastic job bringing awareness onto Decathlon, who nobody paid attention to, but they did a great job. Dan and Dave, and who are you going to root for? Well, Dan O'Brien was on world record pace and no heights at Olympic trials, so it doesn't even go to the Olympics. And I started following his career because I'm like, how does that happen? That doesn't make any sense. He sees mental coach, sports psychologist, someone help him out his routine, distractions with confidence, and started following his career. And then I was like, this is a career. This is what I want to do. So it parlayed into that like perfectly. I need to add another point, Mike. It's like I just thought of like my favorite part of high school sports as well, what I think about the most. And sorry that I'm bringing this back up now, but
no, it's you're
like
good.
What I honestly remember is running the hill in soccer. And I don't know why that always stands out to me, man, but I just remember there was some righteousness and a camaraderie and this feeling of togetherness when you have a bunch of other people doing the same hard thing. And remember coach kind of playing the, you don't have to do this, Rob, like you don't have to do this. You get to do this sort of, mind trick at the time. Like, oh, okay. I kind of get to do it. I get it. But it made sense later on. And I always loved the training and the harder it was, the more I loved like pushing it. And that was a skill then that still lasted like way beyond, right? Cause now I do ultra marathons, everything, but sorry for the tangent, but that is probably what I think about most when I think about like my sport and career. when it comes to it.
So what are the steps that you take as you decide, okay, sports psychology is where I want to be? Obviously, you're in school, you're taking the classes, you're trying to figure out what that looks like. What are some steps that you started to take, whether it was through trying to connect with people or just putting your ideas down on paper about where you were going to go next and how you were going to get where you wanted to go?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it was, you know, started just reading as much as I could. And this was even in undergrad, man. So I started working with like even some, you know, some of my fraternity brothers who played on the soccer team there in college. You know, we kind of, you know, let's do some visualization together and kind of lead them through some stuff, you know, just no idea what I'm doing, just trying to come up with this. And it was, you know, I always think it's like when you know what's going to be, what the plan is, you don't know what the path is. So I had no idea what the path was going to be, but I knew what the ultimate goal was. That was work with professional athletes, coaches, and teams, helping them perform their best when it matters the most. So I had no idea like what the plan was. I knew in my mind, when I graduated college, though, I was going to move out to Colorado and be a ski bum for a year. And the reason why I was doing that is because I love skiing. And I remember seeing it like as a kid, like, wait, people do this. Like, I had no idea like what a ski bum was, but I was like, oh, people do this like as a career. Like, I want to do that. And it was one of those things. The reason why I share that is because it was one of those things where it's like, I didn't know what the plan was. Like, I know I'm going to go to grad school. I'm going to figure out a way. And, but I'm doing this, man. I'm going to do, and because I wasn't going to be 37 years old picking up and then moving out to Colorado being a ski bum. Like, that just doesn't work. You know what I mean? So it's like, you have to do it now. And took that leap, skied like 97 days that year, and then went to grad school at Temple University the next year. Now, if you want the story behind it, I got lucky getting in. And the reason why I got lucky getting in, it was simply because of another hinge moment of reading about a study. And to graduate college, you had to replicate a study. So I replicated like this study of like when runners would go on these long runs, they'd have these euphoric sensations, you know, and the runner's high. And I remember like, okay, I just want to do that one. Well, when I applied to Temple University, I'm in the interview. I had no idea who I'm talking to, but he kept asking me about this study that I replicated. And he was the one who did the original research. Runner's wow. High. No idea, none, you know, I just found out after the interview, of course. And, you know, 23 years old, man, and you can tell I knew what I was doing. But it was just getting in there when I got into Temple University. I wasn't going to blow it. I read absolutely everything that I could. And I was immersed in going above and beyond everything that I was going to do because I knew how hard the path was going to go and not even kind of knowing what the path. Then went to University of Tennessee for my doctorate. And you know, all on the way, man, just working with athletes, man.
Did you have a professor or somebody that kind of took you under their wing or somebody that you look upon as a mentor at either one of those places, either at Temple or Tennessee, somebody that you're still in touch with that has been important in your career?
Yeah, I had a couple, man. So it was Dr. Michael Sachs there at Temple University and then that was at Temple. And then at Tennessee was Leslie Fisher and Craig Risberg. I mean, they were just fantastic people, man. And Joe Whitney, I think we always remember our coaches, man, and they were huge.
Who were the first athletes or two that you got to work with?
So getting like my master's degree, man, was probably working like with the team. I remember working with like with Temple Baseball there. That was even the John Chaney days when he was there, man. I remember going and kind of watching some of the 5 a.m. practices, but got nowhere near that team. But it wasn't until, man, I think University of Tennessee, and then just started working with like some local pros. Some local pros then had some success. They got in some bigger tournaments and it just kind of opened up. And that's what I always try to tell athletes and teams is no matter how bad your situation is, no matter how bleak an outcome looks, it only takes one. It takes one shot to turn everything around. It takes one meeting a person, one coach to turn your entire life around. That's what you're getting ready for. Problem is you don't know when that moment's coming. That's the importance of preparation. That's the importance of being ready. That's the importance of always finishing the drill and never going through the motions because you don't know when that opportunity is going to happen. And that's kind of how it played out and, you know, career-wise, professionally.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's great advice for anybody in any walk of life, whether you're talking about athletes, when you're talking about your career, whatever that may be in the business world, you got to be prepared. Luck tends to find people who are prepared for that luck. And if you do that, you're going to put yourself in a much better position to be able to take advantage of those breaks and those hinge moments like you described. Tell me a little bit about your own personal mindset as you're just getting started and trying to figure out, okay, how can I help these guys? What is it that I'm bringing to the table that can help a professional golfer, that can help an athlete to be at their best when their best is needed? What was your thought process? How are you going through and thinking about it? Obviously, you've got a lot of academic background, but you don't have, and when you're first working with athletes, a little different working in the ground versus theoretical. So just tell me a little bit about your mindset.
Yeah. And I kind of shared, you know, like theory and practice are exactly the same, but in practice, they're different. So it's like, I mean, I would probably say I was probably more confident starting off then than I am now. And I know it sounds odd, man, but it's
no, like, it makes total sense.
You know, I mean, my job was to ask like really good questions. And I always think it's like when they come up with it themselves, when they come up with the ideas themselves, that's when they take ownership of it. I'm not a fan of like the term buy-in at all. I don't want to buy it into, I want to take an ownership. And I think they take ownership when it's their idea that they can be able to come up with. And I think that's sort of like the art of coaching as well, right? It's like, but being able to ask good questions, being able to get good feedback. I always think there's so much power in the debrief. I think early on I could help people with their preparation, and I still can, but I thought I could help them with their performance, and I still can, but I still think now I'm more impactful after the event, after they need to debrief it, after they need to look at it and see, man, where were the stumbles? What were the successes? Because now, you know, had success, that this too shall pass. Like success is fleeting. No matter what you win, no matter how great it is, it's what's next and what's on to the next. So you have to have a certain appreciation for just getting better and going through those times. And I know it's like people saying, you know, you just kind of keep going, and it is. But I always struggle with the mountaintop moments, man. Like I wanted those good times to last a little longer. And when you find out that that leaves you empty, you really find out, okay, well, a better foundation is needed in order for to sustain success and to be on this quest of always improving, always getting better, and working like where the real shortcomings are going to be in life, those things are going to kind of trip you up. And I also look at it now as like the better you get, the more important mental toughness is off the court than it is on the court. Everyone does works, you know, extremely hard, right? And then to do the due diligence, but it's going to be what takes place off, you know, off, like how are we communicating? How are we leading? How are the relationships inside our own four walls? You know, how are the relationships like with assistant coaches? All of those dynamics, I think, play more into, you know, the actual game and preparation itself.
And I think you make a great point. It's something that I know you talk about in the book, Puke and Rally, is a lot about that you have to be about the process. You have to enjoy the process. You have to take the time to soak in the process. Because as you said, when you get to that mountaintop, you give several different examples in the book of athletes who got to that proverbial mountaintop that they had been chasing. And all of a sudden they get there and they ask them, so they look around, they say, well, wow, that doesn't feel normally, that doesn't feel quite as good as I thought it would, or man, this isn't quite as meaningful as I thought it was going to be. This here's something that I've worked for years and years and years in some cases. And now I've gotten there and it feels sort of empty. And so I think one of the points that you make very well in the book is that it has to be about more than just that singular accomplishment. It has to be about the process that you go through, and then not only leading to it, but then what do you do, as you said, once you're there, what do you do after that point? So talk a little bit about that and just sort of making sure that you embrace the process.
Yeah, man. I mean, I think the 80-20 rule applies to this one. I think 20% of what you're going to be doing is just, it sucks, right? There's not a lot of fun with it. Okay, but 80% of what you should be doing should be fun. I mean, there should be enjoyment in that. If it's not, then how do we need to, and I, you know, there's a lot of different layers, right? From coaches opposed to entrepreneurs as opposed to athletes, but 80%, like if 80% of your coaching isn't like coaching, it's on the other stuff. We got to really work on that, man. You know what I'm saying? Cause yeah, 20% is going to suck. I get it. But if you don't, if you're not doing the 80% that you love, it is going to drain you and suck the very fiber of why you coach out of you. And that requires, well, I mean, you're going to have to delegate, man. You're going to have to trust other people. You're going to have to allow them to do it and not stress out about that stuff, right? Because I don't know if you know any coaches that aren't control freaks, but like they all are, man. So it's like 80% still has to be done coaching and doing what you love to do. And it happened a couple of weeks ago, even to me, man, a mountaintop moment. Like, and I put it in the book. It's like, you know, people spend 40 days on average climbing Mount Everest. They're on top for minutes.
Yep.
Most deaths happen on the way down from Mount Everest because it's like, hey, man, we reached it. This is it. And it's like, you know, no matter how great it is, man, this too shall pass. Even if it's the best ever, this too shall pass. Like the best steak you've ever had in your life. This is so amazing. My problem is I always wanted them to last a little bit longer. But since the good times could not last, it also means that the bad times can't last either, no matter how bad it is that we're going through. And what we will see only on the reflection piece, right? Because time plus a perspective is what gives you significance of event. But only with that can you see, man, that there was just so much righteousness in, finding a way and going through that tough time there. Because, you know, and that's the part that we look at. It's like, that's the real fun stuff. And so that's where it's always like, I stress to coaches, yes, man, make sure you're celebrating and enjoying like the process along the way, allowing them to have fun, allowing them, to enjoy it. You know, I think Eric Musselman does a great job of that, right? Like, I mean, he'll clown around and, you know, I mean, he's a fantastic coach, man. He's got it down, but he understands like you have to enjoy the process because if the expectations rise faster than your results, man, there's always going to be after you win, after you have a mountaintop moment, there's always going to be somebody that says, man, that's great, coach. All right, what's next? Here's my proof. I don't mind if it's okay if I like date the show.
Absolutely.
It's going to happen in the Super Bowl, man. Whoever wins the Super Bowl, number one, they're going to rank them in terms of, all right, where do they rank in like the best ever? And they're going to say the same exact thing. Can they do it again?
Yep.
Hey man, what are the rankings for next year, right? You want to place a bet on them winning for next year? Because here's what it is. And then confetti hasn't even been cleared from the field. So there has to be something deeper than that, than just holding up the trophy and winning it. There has to be. And I think the more and more that you enjoy the process along the way, it takes so much pressure off of that outcome. And it allows you to kind of soak in these moments, good or bad. And that's the part where I those mountaintop moments, man, are just what I'm all about now. And it's because the good times can't last, it also means the bad times can't last as well, man.
One of the things that goes along with that, I think, that you talk about in the book is how easy it is to get derailed by one mistake or one setback and just say, oh man, this is really taking me off the path that I want to get to. And I think athletes sometimes allow themselves to get knocked off that path for that very reason, that a simple mistake can take you out. And then all of a sudden it can turn into this spiral where one thing that you've done your entire life, boom, you do it wrong once, or you have one bad experience and now you're in like this tailspin. So talk a little bit about athletes again, maybe not getting into specifics, but just when you work with somebody who's had a setback, how do they come back? What do you tell them that, hey, look, you've been doing this your whole life. This one mistake shouldn't be the thing that just completely knocks you off, knocks you off the platform. So how do you deal with an athlete who's suffering through that or who's facing that situation?
Yeah, it's a good point, man. I think we have to approach everything through the concept of like time, and no matter what it is, the problem with like where we're at now in society today, it's like, I mean, just the recency bias of everything that we go through, and we show highlight reels of just one play. The team lost, man. But we're showing like one play. And so the reason why I say the time is because this too shall pass. You have to realize it. Like, this is just a step. You do not reach, and I'll tell my athletes this, you do not reach the highest level without having gone through the really, really difficult time. You can't. There's no way. You cannot fast forward that. Or those that do fast forward it, they get there, but then they're quickly off very quickly, and you never hear from them again because the foundation wasn't there. And so I'm going to use the C word here for a second. All right, I'll say, man, I haven't worked with a pro athlete that hasn't choked. I'm serious, man, that hasn't choked. I want them choking in practice, though, because they can understand where their mind is going to go under pressure. And the part that I really share with them about, it's like, you have to understand your identity outside of sport. You have to understand that this is just something you do. And that when you leave it, like, you have to be able to leave it. You have to be able to disengage this part of your life with the other part, especially the better that you get. Because the better you get, man, the more and more people will be patting you on the back and telling you how great you are. So I equate this, and I share this with them in terms of failure and setbacks. What they never told me was that the quote, the fall down seven, get up eight, right? That was really nice,
right?
4-H saying, man, just fall down seven, get up eight. It never really rang true with me because they never told me that when you fall down for the fourth and fifth time, man, that you remember, you know, the first and second and third, like, you remember those. So all the flood of emotions that come back from getting chewed out by a coach, striking out with the bases loaded, whatever that failure is going to be in our mind, all of those emotions start coming back. Because the body still remembers it, man. The body still holds that stuff in there. And so it's like, you know, those triggers kind of that we have. And like, the reason why we need to overcome that one mistake is because it's that one mistake that isn't the problem. It's really not, man. Like, you know, you have to allow yourself leeway to make mistakes, but that part's okay. If we don't allow ourselves any leeway, then we have to play perfect, and let me know how that works. So the one mistake isn't the problem. It's, now I no longer trust it. Now I no longer, I'm going to shoot. Now I'm no longer going to be aggressive. And then that becomes the problem. Now we're not, now you have no longer trusted yourself or been able to kind of refocus and process that information and what's happened. And now it leads to another mistake. And then it leads to another one. And that's how the domino effect happens, man, where it's not that one mistake. So a lot of times, man, it's, and coaches have to do this as well. Because we're teaching our players, look, you have to move on from the next play. But then when it's a timeout, then we're bringing that last play up, you know, and what they need to do, that's for film time. That's not for this. We need to practice that part of next play mentality. And that's the part where I just look at it, man. I always see like the one mistake, the mistakes are going to happen, it's not a problem. How do you respond after that? The best part about Last Dance with MJ wasn't that he was successful all the time, but he lost.
Yep.
But you let me know, man, like, how many times did he have like losing streaks, you know, or when they lost against Orlando, but he was back next year, man. He was back the next day. And that's the real test of a champion, man, is when you get knocked down, it's always going to be about the comeback. Are you able to develop that next play mentality and really not let that stuff bother you? You show me somebody that can let go of mistakes, I will show you somebody that is mentally tough.
All right. So I want to ask you a current events question related to basketball. And then I'm going to go back in time and share a personal experience and just kind of get your opinions, thoughts about something that happened to me. So I'm going to go with the current situation. So we have a guy in the NBA, Ben Simmons, right? Who is pretty much at this point afraid to go to the free throw line. He's a guy who is 6'10" and 240 pounds and just wants to sit out on the perimeter and not do anything, doesn't take jump shots. You know, it's a basketball player. It's clear that not only maybe at some point was there something physical going on, but there's something going on in his mind that doesn't allow him to perform at his highest level. Now, clearly you're not sitting down in a room with them and talking to them and having a complete understanding. But a player who's in that situation who has the tools to be able to be successful, but for whatever reason isn't able to implement those tools out on the floor, or the field, or the court, whatever, what advice or what, how would you attack a situation like that? What would you do with them? What are some conversations you might have, the questions you might ask them?
You know, it's tough to take that and like generalize it because every situation is going to be a little bit different.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
If it was with Ben Simmons and working with Ben Simmons, the best thing would be if he wasn't Ben Simmons.
Right.
And what I mean by that is because he can't step out of him being himself. So he knows like that light is like always on him in terms of what he's doing. But I mean, he's not really doing anything that we didn't know already before. His biggest mistake was not owning up to it in Philly and being able to take the punches there. Yeah. And then started playing a mental health card, which, look, man, mental health is a big issue. I'm not saying he didn't experience it, but he played that card like you try to play the system, like you try to play man, I got a pass here to go to the bathroom.
Right.
He used that to the utmost where he just, I'm out. Like he didn't stay around and practice. He went and did his own thing. And I can just guarantee this, like he didn't have anybody really speaking truth to him in his life. He had all yes men. He had all people saying, man, you're great. You do whatever you want. But deep down, he knew it and he didn't have to own up to it. When you move on, when you quit, it makes quitting easier later on. The problems, relocation therapy is what I call it. And that rarely, it sometimes works if something isn't broke, but if it's broke, like it was, it's going to show up again. And that was the part where, look, when he had those issues in the playoffs with the Sixers, he needed to get it addressed then. He didn't. You reap what you sow. Now the checks need to get cashed. So, I mean, that's kind of my opinion. Like on.
Got it. All right. So I'm going to give you a personal experience that happened to me. And it's kind of interesting when I look back on it. And I've told this story once on the podcast. We had a guy that came on and Billy Hansen, and he had written a book about his experiences as a college basketball player. And he had some performance anxiety issues and he was kind of walking through and talking about his experience. And it got me thinking about my experience, which I had never shared before on the podcast, really hadn't shared with too many people at all. But so when I was a high school basketball player, I shot probably, I think 89% from the free throw line. And I just, you know, completely confident in every way, shape or form. My freshman year, when I got to college, didn't play very much, but you know, whatever, it was fine. And then when I was a sophomore, I became a starter, and probably about 2/3 of the way through that season, I was shooting, I think 91, 92%, something like that. And then we had this drill that we would do at the end of practice where you had to make 5 swishes in order to be able to leave practice. And then you had a certain amount of time to do that. And if you didn't do it, then you had to get up the next morning at 6 o'clock or something to come in and shoot extra free throws. And some way, shape or form, doing that particular activity one day, I just completely fell apart and collapsed as a free throw shooter. And I think my last, whatever, it was probably the last 6 or 7 games, I think I was 0-for-10 or 0-for-12 from the free throw line. A guy that was previously was 90%. And I mean, I was in practice and, you know, even then I was struggling to try to get the ball to the basket. I mean, I never have experienced at that point anything even remotely similar to that. I mean, it was just, I couldn't get the ball to the basket, and I would get, again, the anxiety and sort of just tense up and all these different things. And I can remember really kind of being completely on an island because I didn't want to admit it really to anybody.
Right.
And I'm sure that my coaches knew. And in fact, I did a podcast with one of my assistant coaches a couple of years ago. And he's like, remember when you had all those free throw problems? I'm like, yeah, probably would have been nice for somebody to talk to me at some point during this whole thing. But anyway, so I finished out that sophomore year, and then I came back as a junior, and in the summer that year, I switched up my routine to try to get myself out of, you know, what I had done before. And I ended up shooting 76%, but it was still sort of an anxiety filled 76%. And then when I was a senior, I shot 82, and it was still, all that stuff was still there. in the back of my mind. But as I was reading your book, one of the things that stuck to me is that even though I went through that and I experienced it, it was terrible. And there's still times today where I can kind of think about it and get that feeling of like, ooh, you know, that I can still feel that muscle tensing up. But for me to be able to overcome that and get back to where, like, again, and during that time when I went through it at the end of my sophomore year, I had no chance of making any shot from the free throw line. And to be able to come back as a senior and be able to get to 82%. And I did it completely on my own. I mean, I didn't talk to anyone about it. And I look back on it now, I'm like, man, how would it have been handled differently? Or what could I have done? It's just interesting for me to think about it. Again, for somebody like yourself who works with athletes who, you know, maybe have experienced the yips, whether it's in golf or whatever it might be, which is certainly how I felt at the time. But it's just a process that I went through. And I wonder, as I look back on it, did I handle it the right way? Did I handle it well? Did I handle it better or worse than somebody else might have? I'm just curious to get your perspective. I know I gave you the very, you know, Cliff Notes version of it, but.
No, man, I can, and I could work with that too. You know what I mean? Cause that, and that just goes to show you like the power of having a skill that's so well learned. And when you try and perfect it, and how that could just kind of like sit in the mind, you know what I mean? And the angst that kind of surrounds it. And then we get stuck inside our head. And when we get stuck inside our head, that's when we're behind enemy lines. The way that we get outside of our own head is to get it out. You have to be able to purge that stuff out. And that's the main thing. It's just be able to share it. And to really then, if you have an expert that can really ask questions in terms of, well, you know, what is the feeling? Like, what's the thoughts? You know what I mean? What's, and now you start unlocking part of that brain that allows it to free up, because you've had one motor pathway for doing something your entire life. Now something got messed up with it because there was a sort of traumatic event, right? I mean, you can call it that. And you've got to be able to figure that one out. And the way that you do it is to be, I mean, that's why, man, being able to get that stuff out takes away the pain, takes away the problem. I always say a problem shared becomes half a problem, because once you start to hear yourself say it, you start to then figure it out and you find a way. When we keep it inside, we're behind enemy lines and we're attacking ourselves. And that's where the real battle takes place, man. And that's the part where it's, I mean, you've got the routine, you got all that stuff, but a lot of those are just going to be fixes. When it's, you know, really delving into, man, what's the feeling, and what's the feeling that you're having when you are shooting well? What's the feeling that you want to have? That becomes a goal instead of 100% outcome and making it and missing it, because then it's tight, then it's tension, and it's really tough to play that way.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I just think back to, like I said, trying to go through and solve that thing on my own and not really talking to anybody, just probably more out of embarrassment than anything else. Like, how can I not do this thing that I've spent hours and hours and hours and hours doing, and I've always been able to do successfully and been able to do under pressure and not ever been worried or nervous or any of that stuff. And then suddenly to have it just in an instant go away, and then to kind of sit with that myself for really a couple of years trying to figure it out. Yeah. Trying to figure that thing out. It's, I think coming back and shooting plus 80%, it might be one of the things I'm most proud of in my entire career. Right. When I really look back on it and say, man, how did I overcome that on my own? How was I able to get to that point where I could do that? It's just, I don't know. The mind is an interesting thing, as you well know. I never would have, before having gone through that, I never would have understood, you know, somebody, you think about the Steve Sachs or the Chuck Knobloch being able to throw the ball to first base, or Rick Ankiel with pitching for the Cardinals and not being able to throw the ball over the plate. I remember seeing those guys.
Yeah. Nick Anderson when he was with Magic.
For sure. Yeah. Against the Rockets. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that I would honestly venture to guess, you know, for anybody who remembers back to that experience, I mean, I think, I don't want to say it completely ruined Nick Anderson's career, but it for sure changed the trajectory of his career. Antoine Walker was the same way with the Celtics. I mean, once he became afraid to go to the free throw line, his entire game changed. I mean, it just changed the trajectory of how you play and what you can do when you're trying to just avoid going to the free throw line. And I can relate to that. I know those last few games of my sophomore year, man, I did not want to get fouled and go to that free throw line. I did not. Whereas prior to that, I was the kid running. I was running to the ball, trying to slam into people to get people to foul me. So totally different. But yeah, Nick Anderson's a great example of that for sure.
Yeah. And that's like, you know, I mean, the analytical side of our mind that figures stuff out. And then it's the part that's got to be creative and just be able to kind of be in flow and let it go and damn the outcome. You know, that's how we kind of get to that spot. And that's why I do love the free throw shooting in general, because of that part, right? It's the only part of the game where everything slows down.
Yep.
Everything stops. Now you got to slow your heart rate down, and now it's just on you. There's a lot of righteousness in that. You know, there's a lot of respect that I have for athletes, and even, you know, mentioning Ben Simmons before, and a lot of respect for anybody that's going to be at that level.
For sure.
You know what I mean? But yeah, dealing with that, it really is, man. It's so powerful because you're taking a well-learned skill and now it's no longer well-learned. Now it's sort of foreign. And so that's where you got to, you know, be starting to do a couple of different things and switch it up. And that's where, like, right away, switching up that routine probably would have been like one of the first actions in that, you know, be able to switch that up because it's going to start a new,
right, new cycle.
I'm getting too geeky in this, but right, starting like a new neural pathway in the mind.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there was no way I could not go back to the old way. The old way was so anxiety inducing that I had to change it. I changed how I brought the ball from dribbling it in my routine to where I shot it. And it was just a whole series of things that, and like I said, I didn't have anybody walking me through the steps. I just was trying to 19-year-old kid, 20-year-old kid trying to figure it out. How do I get back to where I was? And I never got back to where I was 100% completely. But it's interesting thinking about how your mind works and how important it is in performance. And I think that speaks to the value of what guys like you do to be able to help somebody, especially at the highest levels where the pressure is the highest, when you're talking about doing something for a living, to be able to unlock. And as you said off the top, to be able to ask the right questions to get guys thinking in the right way. To me, it's just invaluable, the tools that you can provide to an athlete. I'm sure that you've seen it. I'm sure that clients that you've worked with have come back to you and said, hey man, like the things that you're working with me on have made all the difference. I'm sure. Can you share a story maybe that an athlete gave to you without naming names, just somebody who maybe, you know, came back to you and just how that made you feel, the impact that you were able to have on them?
I mean, because I was the athlete that thought too much and I was like the Sheldon from Big Bang Theory. you know, I would overanalyze stuff, man, overanalyze it. And I was also an all or nothing athlete. Like if I was good, I was good. If I was bad, I was horrible. Right. Because the one mistake would then lead to another. And it was,
right,
just, it was a downside. So like to have athletes, have success, man, it really does, man. It brings me so much joy. It's better being a coach and watching their success, because then, you know, hearing about it and being able to share it with them is just so special, man. It really is. It's the best part about what I do.
Yeah, it's powerful stuff.
The first training camp Elite Skill Development and Performance Combine will be held on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, powered by Unleash Potential and the Hoopheads podcast. The camp is designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9 and will take place June 29th through July 1st, 2023. An emphasis on improving individual skills in the context of a team environment will be the hallmark of the training camp. Mike Klinzing from Head Start Basketball and the Hoopheads podcast and Joe's Decision from Unleashed Potential will serve as the camp directors of this inaugural training camp. Campers can expect 3 days of hard work, intense skill instruction, and learning how to be a great teammate on and off the court at the training camp. Players will participate in 10 elite skill development sessions led by some of the best coaches from across the country. Visit headstartbasketball.com to get registered.
Talk a little bit about your journey to becoming an author. Go back to writing your first book and Did you know you had a book in you? Was it something that you sort of came to by accident? Was it a plan? Just tell me a little bit about the process.
All right. So let me start with this about how bad of a writer I was.
Okay.
Like I said, from the very beginning, never studied at all in high school, got to college. Now I had to study. No idea about that, right? Like no idea about how to do it, but now you had to. And, you know, because in high school, I got straight B's. But I was like, why work really hard and try and get A's? Why can't I just get B's and not do anything? You know, well, I didn't know. And so this is how bad I was. I get to college. And you remember, like, when they'd have the writing test, you'd have the writing test before school would start. Are you going to be in English 101 or English 201?
Right.
And this is before even, like, I didn't take, advanced placement English. Advanced placement English. I didn't take that. So like you do the test and I did the test. This is how bad I was, coach. I was in English 010. Like I wasn't even in the class where you got a credit, man. You had to take it in order to get into 101.
Right.
I told my daughter that the other day. She was just laughing hysterically. I said, yeah, man, but you know, there's 8 books right there. So it's like horrible writer. I only became a good writer because of going through the thesis and then going through the dissertation, and you got to make it shorter and you have to, I mean, you have to make that one perfect. And I knew then coming out, one, I loved writing because it's then my way. Same thing when I was talking about getting outside of our own head, writing for me became a way to get outside my own head, to put these ideas down and create something and be able to help somebody else out with it. So I knew that I had something to say, and I knew, look, like the hinge is, I mean, none of anything I'm saying isn't like, hasn't been said before, but I was like, can there be a better way to say it? And how do we take examples from other people and be able to put this in there? And how do we keep this simple? That's basically how the books write. And the process, I wish I could really say I was good at it. I'm not good at it. The process for me writing the book is 1 hour every day, 1 hour every single day. And then you're going to have a book that gets done. Now for this one, man, it turned in like a couple hours a day, just because it just, this, my next book was not coming together. It just was not fitting. And then I like to do tough stuff, man. I like to get out there and world and live life, because that's fodder for the book, man. And we're always going to learn that stuff. I mean, life goes so damn fast, man, that if we're not sucking the nectar out of life and doing everything that we can to like maximize the enjoyment, it's going to pass us by. So whatever it is that we want to do, man, you have to be able to do it, because it's not going to wait for you. You want to go live out in Colorado, man, do it. If you want that vacation with the family, you better put it on the plan and go do it, because it's not going to be a convenient time for anything. And so I will sign up for these races that force me in order to train and to put myself out there, because I need to learn more about myself and what it is that, you know, who am I going to be able to help in this race? Who, you know, put me in a situation that I can be able to help somebody. And that only happens in life and what the race is going to be. So that's sort of the process, man, of like writing. But I always think I got something to say, and excited about the next book as well, man, because I really think this one is just the avenue towards how we can really improve, you know, our mental game.
All right. Puke and Rally. Tell me about the title. One, it obviously is something that grabs you. It's not a word puke that you typically see in the title of a book. So as you were going through and trying to come up with what's the title going to be, what were some of the alternatives, or was it always just Puke and Rally right from the very beginning? Cause that was sort of the whole thing that it was based on.
It was, brother. It was, I wanted Puke and Rally to be a nice title. I didn't want it to be a scarlet letter that I would wear around. And all my ultra marathons, man, I just could not get like the sodium electrolyte balance. And I really struggled with heat, man. And, I can tell the whole story if you want about how Puke and Rally came to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Please.
There was a 50K race, and it was in the mountains, and there was, you know, the training for it wasn't as great, had a little injury heading in. And, but no matter what, right, then do the race. And, you know, 32 miles, like in the mountains, man, it's not like, you know, a flat road marathon, you know, it's 6 more miles, but that 6 miles right there is 2 hours. It's not running on an 8-minute clip. Now, if you're ultra elite, you know, perhaps, yeah, I mean, those guys still do. But I started to have some engine failure at about mile 13, about mile 20 of this race. I started to have like some serious shutdown issues, you know? So I'm like, all the self-talk you try and do yourself means nothing at these moments, because what fatigue makes cowards of us all, man. It's like when you get depleted, there's no motivational talk that's really going to help it. You know, it's just you and the decision, and decisions whether to keep going or not. So I'm at mile 20 of this race, severe shutdown issues. I need to get to mile 24. Mile 24 is when I'm going to see my family. They're going to be there. I'm going to reset, re-engage, and then, you know, 8 more miles to finish this race that I need to train better for next time. I get to, this is how bad it was, man. Like they climbed down to where I was going to be coming, because there was like, so I was just walking at this point, man, you know, extreme heat. I mean, you know, high 80s, all humidity. And when I get up to the top of this aid station where they kind of walked, this is how bad I was at that point. My kids, young at the time, right? Like 8 and 6 at the time, they walk down this hill to see me. I see them. They're hiking ahead, man. I'm having to stop like every 30 yards and just sit, you know, because it's not good, right? It's not good. And I get up to the top of the aid station. And when I get to the top of the aid station, man, that's when it opens up. Like I just start puking. I mean, projectile vomit. My kids are kind of looking at me and like, what is going on? Right. And my wife is there. She sees my sunken in eyes and like, it's not good. Well, right when that happens, the skies open up and the sky just starts dumping. I mean, dumping, man. So we have to retreat to the car. It was an aid station. They had pulled up. So they were there, retreat to the car. If you can picture it in your mind, it's pouring down rain in the middle of the day. I'm opening up the back door of the car, projectile vomit, closing the door, looking at my kids now just crying because they have no idea what's going on, right? None. And my wife then comes in. She says, I told them that I'm pulling you from the race. And I couldn't argue at that point. I had no recourse. I couldn't do anything. You know, I couldn't argue with it in the rain. It was gave a convenient excuse. We go back to the hotel, the cabin where we're staying, where we rented for the week. Now I have like the chills, dry heaves, you know, take a shower, try and pass out for a little bit, kind of wake up. And I don't know how long that was, man, maybe 30 minutes or something like that. Start to kind of get my bearing a little bit. They kind of come back because they had lunch. They all lay down because they went through traumatic event as well. Now I'm up. I start sipping on some water. And then it became one of those who are you moments. And those are the moments where we really meet ourselves. And one of my golfers always used to say, like, we didn't come here to paint. And that stuck with me. I was like, man, we didn't come here to paint. Like, you're going to finish this race. So I go in, I kind of shake my wife and say, we're going back to finish this race. 2 hours, mind you, after this all went down, I'm back at the same spot and check back in. And they were kind of shocked I was back, right? They're like,
right. Really? Like, this guy bet 2 hours.
Drop. Yeah, man. It's like, okay, you know, go ahead. And end up finishing the race. And I share that one because it's like, all right, what are we really made of? We don't really know until those moments hit. And what I knew was that I was going to finish the race or I was going to die while I was out there. There was no other option. I think if you keep it as simple as that, for me, not saying it's the best, you keep it as simple as that, you remove all the other options, the other back doors are going to be there in life because we're going to take them. You're left with a singular focus. And I'm the one that had to look at myself the very next day. And that became sort of the impetus that no matter how bad it is, man, it's not about the setback. It really isn't. Setbacks are inevitable. Every one of us has puked. What does it take to rally? What do you need to rally? Got to have people around you that care about you. Got to have people around you that push you and challenge you. And you have to have opponents too, man, that test you. But that became the impetus of the book, man. And that's sort of like where it took off. And I've done this race 6 times. I still have, my goal is still a podium finish for this race. Every one of them, coach, every single one of them, I've puked. I've still puked in this race because it's always so hot. We're coming from the winter, into its spring. And for some reason, it's always in the 80s or 90 degrees, man. I just struggle so bad. Last time, I'm serious, I made it like 100 yards from the finish before I had a light puke. But I'm going to do it, man. Every time it gets a little bit further, and it's a tough race, man. But, you know, again, I've done a 100-miler, puked in that one. It's just about just keep moving no matter what. Really, it's really what it comes down to, man.
It's a great story because I think it does speak to kind of what you've been talking about throughout our conversation tonight, which is you have this internal dialogue with yourself of who am I and what am I all about? And I have to go through this process in order to prove it to myself, to be at my very best. And it speaks to understanding what the process is. Like, you weren't finishing that race so that you could take a photo at the finish line and have that as a memento. Like, that isn't what that whole thing was about for you. It was about the process of going through it and the struggle, and then understanding how that was going to change you as a human being and what that was going to represent for who you were continuing to become. And I think that's a powerful statement about what human growth potential is all about, right? Like, you could have walked away and gone and laid down in the bed and gotten up the next day and continued on with your life. But you inside your own head had something that was driving you to continue to grow, to become a better person as a result of that experience. And to me, that's a powerful thing that I think a lot of people miss when we take the easy way out.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing it, man. It's sort of like a strength and piece that I always rely on. And it's like, you know, just be, you know, mental toughness has a lot of different facets to it. It's not one size fits all. That's one part of like mental toughness. People would look at it and it's like, well, that was a stupid decision. I'm not going to argue with it, right? I'm not saying it wasn't, but I just knew what was acceptable to me. Not giving up, for me, that's a strength. I can do that. Letting go of mistakes, big trouble for me, right? Well, I know people that can let go of mistakes really well. So like, there's a whole lot of different areas of like being like what mental toughness is and mentally tough. And you've got to be able to find what the strength is for you and make sure that that's like you hammer that home in terms of, look, I'm really good at this. How can I help others with this part? And how can I look at models and coaches to be able to help me like with the areas that I'm weak at? So I always look at it in terms of like mental toughness is not, this is what I know mental toughness isn't. It's not all or nothing. It's not. There's so much gray in life. It's not just one. It's not just yes or it's not just no. There's a whole lot of gray that's going to be in life, and we have to live in that gray and be able to navigate the sticky factor, right? The fact that this just does not feel good about what we're doing. But just knowing that no matter what, we're going to stick to it and be able to keep trusting that process, making adjustments along the way. A sailboat is off course 99% of the time. 99% of the time, a sailboat is off course. They get to their destination by tacking, making zigzagging maneuvers and making adjustments along the way. And that's what life's about.
That's perfect that was the next thing you went to, because that was the exact next story that I was going to ask you to go to, was to tell the story of Diana Nyad, because I think her experience is similar to yours in a way, in that there was an interruption. And then your interruption was 2 hours. Her interruption was a little bit longer than that. So maybe just share with the audience that story and how it relates to what you just talked about in terms of the sailboat being off course for 99% of the trip.
Yeah. I mean, Diana Nyad. So if anybody hasn't read the book, her book is just, Find a Way. I mean, she just, you know, no big deal, right? Just swam from Cuba to Florida Keys, you know, first person to ever do it. And you just look at that stuff. I mean, that was 54 hours of continuous swimming. You know what I mean? And here's the funny thing, Mike. It's like, you will still see people that discount like what she did. You know what I mean? It's like people that just can't, it was out there on blog that I would just couldn't do it. There had to have been something that she cheated on. You know what I mean? Like, even if we do something great, you're still going to anger half the people that just have no idea, like, how people can do amazing things like that. And not to belabor the point, man, but it's like, you know, just coming from a golf tournament, and the governor of Arizona was introduced, and my son's with me. Everybody started booing. You know, I didn't know the story behind it. Everybody started booing. And my son was like, I thought they just said that was the governor. I said, buddy, I said, they don't boo nobodies.
Right.
I said, trust me here, man. If it was nobody, they wouldn't clap. They wouldn't boo. You're going to be, if you reach any level of success, you're going to be hated by half the people. It doesn't matter. They don't even know you. That's not the point. The point is, you know, those that are around you and that you can touch and make a difference in their lives, not to have the cheers of everybody, because that ain't going to happen. But yeah, Diana Nyad, man, I mean, we just talk about, hours and hours and hours of training. It took her multiple years, 30 years, something she picked up. She didn't pick back up until her 50s, and then was 64 years old when finished this. Just amazing feat, man, and just total doggish when it comes to never giving up, man, and always persevering. And that's the stuff that I love, man, when it comes to that. And those stories are still getting written right now, man. That's the part that, like, to be that consistent with your process is something else.
Tell me a little bit about the difference between working with a golfer, a football player, somebody from a different sport. What are some things that are sort of universal that you talk with athletes about, or questions that are universal, and then maybe something that's sport specific?
Yeah. So, like, the mental skills are what are universal. So, like, and I kind of put it up always, I think there's a hierarchy of mental toughness. Number one is, like, you have to have the motivation, like your why, right? How bad do you want it? That drive, that part. And that's usually where most mental coaching, like, stops, is that piece, right? Like, you know, do whatever it takes sort of thing. And, you know, it's true. That has to be there. It has to be something that you own and that you just don't feel whole without it. Like, there was a scene in Rocky II when he's carrying the buckets, right? Like, he's not fighting. He's carrying the buckets, just working the gym. And he's like, man, like, why do you want to work here, Rock? Like, you just fought for a world championship. Why do you want to work here? And he said, I just need to be around it.
Yep.
And you just got to be around it. And so when it's part of, like, your fabric of what you're going to do, the motivation piece takes care of itself. From that, you have confidence. And confidence, people would think it's the most important. I'm not disagreeing. I do think it is. But on the hierarchy of mental toughness, the reason why it's next is because, look, if you weren't confident, you wouldn't try anything.
Right.
So the confidence is there. And it's letting people know that the confidence is there. You just have to be able to remove the barriers that of what you're telling yourself on a daily basis from that. So confidence is king, no doubt, but focus is queen. And these are all, like, these skills are universal no matter the sport or context. Focus is queen. So in the game of chess, the way that the game is lost is through confidence, through the king. You just kill the king in chess, the game's over. When you lose confidence, it's tough to bring that back. It really is. So, well, the way, though, that we get confident is through our focus. Not too many times are we actually playing the game thinking about, oh, I'm really confident. We don't really think that way. We think about making the next shot. We think about making the next play. We think about how good we're feeling and how much fun we're having, right? It's focus. When we get off, where's our focus go? Not making a mistake. Focus goes on, like, getting internal, right? Not wanting to go to the line. And now our focus has been interrupted. So I say confidence is king, focus is queen. That's how the game is won, is what we're focused on. What are the things that we're saying to ourselves? What's our body language? And are we embracing, like, that moment? Are we getting excited? And then the last one is refocus. How well are we letting go of mistakes, moving on, and really forgetting it, totally forgetting it from shot to shot, play to play, game to game, season to season, being able to move on. So those are the skills that I think are ubiquitous in every single sport. It's just the context that changes, and the arousal level, you know, whether it's going to be football or whether it's going to be, you know, basketball or golf or tennis, like, all those contexts will change, but the base of all the mental skills are the same.
That's well said. No, you did. That clearly answers the question. I think when you start talking about what are things that are all encompassing that go across all sports, I think you answered that really, really well. And I think made it clear for people out there kind of where mental toughness falls. As you've said numerous times, I think sometimes we throw it all into one category and there's a whole wide variety of different things that encompass what it means to be mentally tough. And some people are better at one aspect of it maybe than another. All right. I want to ask you final two-part question. So part one is when you look ahead over the next year or two and you think about where you're at in your career, what you're doing, who you're working with, the next book idea, whatever it might be, what are some of your biggest challenges or what's your biggest challenge going forward over the next year or two? And then second part of the question is when you think about what you get to do every day, what brings you the most joy in what you get to do? So your biggest challenge and your biggest joy.
My biggest challenge, I mean, the next book is I can't wait to be patient and the fastest way to get there. And that has consumed me because I know it's a good book and I know this is the avenue that we have to take, man, because without a doubt, it's supply and demand theory when it comes to time. It's the most precious resource that we have, supply and demand. When we're a kid, we have all the supply in the world, no demand. We think there's demands, right? There's not. All right. Only when we get later, when we realize that now the supply is limited and now the demand is greater, that then we can appreciate the sanctity of time. You can always make more money. You can always make different friends, but you can never get this time back. And it's kind of back to the original point I was saying, man. It's just like, man, you have to like seize. People say seize the moment, seize the day, but it's getting a whole new appreciation for time. And when you can approach everything through that avenue of time, why am I getting stressed out about this situation here? Why am I reacting in this situation when 5 years from now, it's not going to be that big of a deal? Why am I getting stressed out in traffic when I'm still going to make it? I'm not going to get so bent out of shape. Because, and it's kind of all ties into the question, man, but it's like, look, we need to approach things with a sense of urgency. We really do. There's no easing into a street fight. You walk into a game trying to ease into a game, you're down pretty quick. So you have to approach everything that we're doing with a sense of urgency. You got to be patient with the results, no matter what. You got to be patient with other people. You have to accept what's happened. And because we approach it with a sense of urgency, and this is dog mentality, right? I'm not talking about people that, you know, read the directions and expect the cake to appear or work out for a little bit and expect to, like, you know, lose all this weight and all that stuff. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking to the dogs, talking about those that are urgent about what they do. The problem with that is now we become urgent in everything that we do, and everything is not urgent. And it's knowing when do we need to be urgent and how do we be patient. And that's the real dichotomy, man, that if we can use time to our advantage, the stress, the anxiety, the overwhelmed feeling that we feel can leave. Because back to that, look, if you can wait, then you can win. And it's just not treating, it's treating that which is important, very urgent, but that which is unimportant with no urgency whatsoever, because it's not going to maximize our time. I mean, there's tons of examples, right, man? You get an email at 9 o'clock. I got to answer this right now. No, you don't. You know, you've made it urgent, and then yep. You make it urgent, and that's what the mind wants to do. So that's sort of the biggest challenge, man, is just that education piece. And how do we make this into a path that, you know, all coaches and dogs are going to be able to use, man, is that most precious resource. Cause I just don't think we use it the best. And then my greatest, so hopefully that answers it, man.
No, it does.
Challenge. And then the other part, what gives me the greatest excitement? I mean, I always work with a team, and the team that I work with, always brings me joy, because it's the only way that I kind of stay young and in tune. I have no idea who the artists are with like music today. You know what I mean? I need them, and I need to hear like the things that they go through. And that's how I think that we stay, you know, young as well, and to make sure that they keep enjoying this process. And, the art of, there's no more important person in life today than a coach, more than ever. most important people. And sometimes these coaches are the most, the only person in somebody's life. And I think when we accept that responsibility and when we take that, we don't know what messages are going to stick. We don't know when they're really going to get this point and then apply it. We have no idea, right? So what we do though is I just have this belief that we plant in trees that we're never going to see. The fact of us being able to tell somebody and directly, you know, like, I'm really proud of you for the effort you're putting in and I believe in you and know you can do it. We don't know the impact of that, but it is going to make a difference. And that's what I just love doing, man. I love planting trees that I'm not going to see. Eventually I'll see one of them, you know, and that becomes those crying moments, man, those tear moments, is being able to reach people and just be able to help them. And because when you do that, you help everybody else out. And what Arthur Ashe said, you know, the most selfish thing they can do is help somebody else. It's so true, man. When you focus on other people, it's what really helps you out. It invigorates you, because you can't help people that you believe in them and then turn around and not believe in yourself. It doesn't work. And that's what I always look forward to, man, is working with athletes.
That's powerful stuff. I mean, I think that it's important for any coach, any level, any sport, to keep in mind that the things that you say and the impact that you have on your athletes are things that they're going to carry with them in some cases for the rest of your life. And I think that we sometimes forget about it, the power that our voices carry and the things that we say carry. And I think you did an excellent job of sharing that. And it's very well said.
Thanks, man.
Before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to share how people can find out more about you. How can they connect with you? Tell them where they can get Puke and Rally. Just tell us a little bit about how we can get connected to you.
Yeah, thanks, man. And I appreciate you having me on, man. And great questions. My website's drrobbell.com. So it's drrobbell.com. You know, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, man, I'm always on there. You know, Puke and Rally and any of my books, man, it's on Amazon or on the website as well. Got a newsletter, goes out every single Friday on mental toughness, one way or another. And it's always kind of like what we get back to. And it's what I wake up in the morning thinking about and kind of what I go to bed thinking about as well, man. So it's just, man, how can I be able to take these and be able to help people out with them? It's my passion. And those are the best ways, I think, to always get a hold of me, man.
Rob, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule tonight to jump on with us. It's been an absolute pleasure getting a chance to pick your brain and learn a little bit more about what you do. And I appreciate you sending me out the book. It was really well done. And I'm going to have to dive into the rest of the library here over the next couple of weeks because I really enjoyed Puke and Rally. So anybody who's out there as a part of our audience, if you get a chance, please go out and pick up the book. Please follow Rob, join up for his newsletter. And again, can't thank you enough for taking the time, Rob. It's been a lot of fun. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the portfolio guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.